Hello and welcome to Being Well. I'm Forrest Hanson. We talk about developmental psychology a lot on the podcast. If you have listened for a while, you definitely know this. And there's no doubt that the early years of our life have an outsized impact on us. After all, they help build the habits and patterns that can set the tone for what comes after, during a time when the brain is particularly malleable. And it can sometimes feel like every conversation about psychology or mental health or personal development comes back to some version of, well, what happened to you in childhood? What was your relationship with your parents like? And if it's so high impact back then, there can be this feeling of like, well, what can we even do today to overcome all of that? But the truth is that for most people, there is so much we can do these days to come to terms with what happened back then, recover from those experiences, change our patterns, and make our lives the way we want them to be. And that's what we're going to be focusing on today. So to help us along here, I'm joined by clinical psychologist Dr. Rick Hanson. Rick is a best-selling author, and if you're new to the podcast, he's also my dad. So Dad, how are you doing today?
I'm very good personally. Always happy to be with you, Forrest. And wow, what a topic. I mean, I'm still processing my childhood and finding hidden gems and hidden sorrows and hidden opportunities, you know, for growth and repair. So it's a work in progress. So I'm really glad that we're exploring this topic.
Yeah, totally. Totally agree with you. By way of a caveat here to start with, the first line from Anna Karenina is one of the most famous lines in literature. Happy families are all alike, and every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. What this means is that most happy childhoods share common features for people, basically enough resources, emotionally available caregivers, all of that stuff. But a lack of any one of those things could be a reason that you had a challenging childhood. So there's enormous individuality here. And when you're on a podcast like ours, we have to try to generalize at least a little bit. As I often joke about on the podcast, you're a guy who really likes a three-part plan. And I'd like to start by just asking you, is there a typical structure or framework to the work that people do in this territory? Like if somebody walked into your office and this was a real goal for them to come to terms with those experiences, what would the arc of that work look like?
I knew you would ask me this, and so I've given some reflection to it, and I've come up with the three R's. No, it's just coincidental.
Fill out your Being Well bingo card right here.
That the first letter of my name also starts with an R, but we're just going to let that go.
A little self-referential here. I like it.
So for me, it's, and I'll explain, reclaim, resupply, and repair. A quick thumbnail for each one?
Yeah.
So reclaim is about bringing compassionate clarity to whatever happened, 0 to 20. You could even extend it 0 to 25. And bringing compassionate clarity, it means developing a coherent narrative, to use that term from attachment theory. It means seeing all the many parts that were in play with compassion for yourself and how you were really affected, and also compassion for others who were involved. Not to paper over anything or let anybody off the hook, but just to bring clarity to it. It is really the case that the truth does set us free. And with that compassion and clarity, there's a sense of reclaiming, because very often in our childhood, we become alienated from our own bodies, alienated from others, alienated from our surroundings. And so there's a kind of reclaiming of it all. And in that reclaiming, new narratives can emerge in which you look back at what happened and you decide to tell the story differently. Same facts, same character, but highlighting different themes, particularly themes of coping, virtue, effort, you know, a kind of inner nobility, a hero's journey, if you will. And we'll probably get into some of those details. So that's reclaiming. Resupplying, very straightforward, filling up ourselves today with what was missing when we were young, both what was missing and also filling ourselves up today with the things that help us to heal and soothe the wounds of childhood, not just, you know, the absence of the good, but the presence of the bad. So that's resupplying and looking for those things today that would be particularly high impact given the childhood you had. And then last, repair. If you can do it in the real with your siblings and your parents, if they're still around, perhaps others, Skillful, appropriate repair can be really helpful. Sometimes we can only make repairs inside our mind because it's not safe to talk with people or not possible. And we can also repair internally parts of ourselves that we've perhaps shamed or exiled or been mean to or wounded. We can repair that as well. So those would be my three R's: reclaim, resupply, and repair.
I actually wasn't aware before we started this episode, just so people know, that you were just going to like drop that on me here.
That's
which is
right.
Great. And
part
also,
of the fun for me.
It's part of, it keeps you on your toes a little bit. And also, I think that you've given me like a fantastic map for what we're probably going to talk about for the rest of the episode, because essentially everything that I wanted to talk about today falls underneath one of those three R's. So I think it's just a fantastic framework for starting.
That's a relief. Another R for you.
Maybe there could be a little relief sprinkled in there for people. Definitely. Just to name another thing here at the beginning, I think that where things often really start like ground floor, first square for people in therapy is with some basic psychoeducation. If you're coming to these kinds of challenges and you have maybe a general understanding that, you know, childhood matters and I'm experiencing these things today and what does this one thing have to do with this other thing? Often a therapist will really start by letting people feel into their common humanity by making these kinds of problems normal problems.
Yeah.
Like it is very, very normal for whatever your version of a challenging childhood, whatever that was for you, to have an impact on you today. So some basic psychoeducation can fulfill that role. And it can really help reduce shame along the way, which is a major issue that people deal with here.
Absolutely true. So where do you want to start here?
Dad, you really just kind of set us up. So I think we could start with a little reclaiming here. And one of the things that you highlighted underneath that R is the narrative development part of it. And I think it might be helpful to just start by you explaining the importance of that a little bit more.
Okay, sure. Humans are meaning-making animals. We make meaning. And the meanings that we make out of our experiences, for example, we appraise situations in certain kinds of ways. We interpret events, like in our childhood, by which I really mean, like I said, conception to 25, roughly. Although we're going to definitely emphasize, you know, sort of through high school. And after that, you know, it's more like young adulthood. So what are the meanings? How do you appraise them? And how do you appraise yourself? Do you appraise yourself as, you know, a bad person, a bad kid, maybe a dummy because you had a learning issue with reading early on? Or do you appraise yourself as a wimp? That's how I appraised myself a lot as a kid when I was young. Or do you appraise yourself, do you regard yourself as someone who was no saint as a child, but certainly someone who brought a lot of pluck and effort and goodness and to bear in a kind of positive and admirable way? You know, how do we appraise it? Another aspect of meaning making is, what are the intentions or qualities you attribute to others? So we have appraisals and attributions. Those are two categories that are kind of useful to think about. Did you think that your older sibling was really out to get you? What were their intentions, right? Do you think that inside the mind of your mother was a intention to kind of bring you closer to her, to be a little bit of her confidant and even therapist because she was unhappy with your father? Let's say it was a heterosexual kind of relationship. Let's say it was a marriage, right? What are the intentions you attribute? And could you be right or wrong? So there's a lot about that that's useful. I want to name two things and then maybe two more things that I think are worth really thinking about. A lot of people don't take into account when they look back on their youth. And we're really focusing here on the full range, from just absolutely atrocious childhood experiences, just horrible, all the way through a really good childhood, a really happy childhood that still has some challenges in it. So how do we form a compassionate clarity about all of that? Well, one thing to reflect on is your own temperament and anything else that was biological for you, like health issues. Also, your temperament. Were you a highly sensitive person or someone who was more stoic? Another major category is, what did everybody else bring to the party? In other words, what was the background of your parents? What kind of setting were you in? If you had siblings, what did they bring to the party? What else was going on? You know, we often overestimate our own influence over situations and tend to overestimate how much they're about us, when in fact, we have a bit part in other people's dramas, and we're in the middle of their bad day or bad year or bad decade often. So what was going on with those other people? That's worth taking into account. And then I'll just say last, how about the other kids? There's a lot of research. It was kind of revelatory. You know, in psychology, there was this huge emphasis, starting with Freud, on early childhood. And then in the 1990s and onward, there began to be a kind of revisionist approach to that that began to point out that for many young people, their peers, for better or worse, had much more influence over their outcomes than their parents did, for example. I think in many ways that was probably true for me. You've talked about that as maybe in some ways true for you in terms of negative influences. And then the last thing I just want to call out is really tricky to name, but I think it's incredibly important. And it also relates to forming a wiser, more hopeful narrative, is to take into account your own agency as a kid, even a young kid, the ways in which in your own mind you made choices. I made choices when I was a teenager that I did deliberately. And they too had many, many ripples. Now, the responsibility, the moral culpability of a kid is obviously different from an adult. But if we don't write in the agency of the teenager in our narrative, we're leaving something important out. And then it becomes something incomplete and even false about the total picture here. Okay, I'll pause. What do you think about the things I've said?
I think it's great. And I'd also just like to pull out a couple of aspects of it that have been particularly important for me and are maybe a little bit different than the things we've talked about in the past when we've touched on this topic in various ways during other episodes. So for me, there's this paired function between identifying what was going on back then. For most people, this is going to be a lack of some kind. Sometimes things are challenging because there's too much of something also. Mm. But I would say for most people, most of the time, it's because there's a lack of something. So what's the lack for you? Was it a lack of a emotionally supportive relationship with your caregivers? Was it a lack of resources? Was it a lack of the opportunity to express yourself or opportunities for play and exploration or opportunities to feel agency in your life? Like, what was your lack? And as you go through creating this coherent narrative, you can really drill down and figure out what the root is of whatever suffering you were experiencing. For a lot of people, it's going to be some need or some want that they really had deep inside, some itch that just could never be scratched for whatever reason. They were never able to express themselves in the way that they want to, or they were never able to have the emotional experience that they were searching for. For a lot of people, that emotional experience is the feeling of A, just emotional safety, and B, being enough just as they are for being a being. A lot of kids are put into a position where they feel like they need to perform a role for other people in order to be loved. And wow, that's a tough spot for an 11-year-old to be in if that's the learning about the world that you're taking out into it. And then the paired part of this process is identifying what the problem is today for you that is coming from that experience, that lack back then. So what are the consequences really? Like, what's going on in your life these days? What is it that you're actually trying to impact or change by going through this kind of a process? And that figuring out, that pairing together is incredibly powerful because what it does is it gives you a map for what you're trying to do these days.
That's great. Could you give a concrete example of that, let's say?
Yeah, examples are good here. So let's take a really common example. Let's say that you are somebody who felt like you were with pretty good parents who were interested in you and, you know, did love you in their heart. but they were simply not that emotionally available. They weren't that interested. They weren't that attuned. They were very interested in your grades, but like not so interested in how you felt about those grades. It was more of a functional relationship. That's a very normal relationship for a lot of people to have with their parents. And so what do you learn from that? Well, you learn that when you perform well in various ways, you are praised and rewarded. And when you don't, you aren't. And your emotions kind of don't really matter that much along the way. So what do a lot of like very wise children learn how to do? They learn how to perform regardless of how they feel. And so you've got these people who pop out in adulthood who are highly invested in maintaining a level of performance, but who feel fundamentally disconnected from their interior, disconnected from their emotions, having a hard time relating to other people along that spectrum because they just don't have practice. And whenever it popped out of them in the past, it was very like painful and wounding along the way because they were punished for it. Or maybe even worse, they were ignored. And so they just kind of learned to devalue that. So maybe that person is now walking around in adulthood and they're walking into your office, Dad, because they're like, wow, I want to learn how to feel these feelings in a measured way without them just exploding out of me because I'm either totally inhibited or totally disinhibited. And so that's an example of how a situation, a challenge in childhood might lead to a set of issues in adulthood that a person wants to work on. And I think that getting clarity about where things are coming from can really give us a lot of insight into what to do about them.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about that?
Well, what I would say more what I feel is the younger layers in myself and their longings. And as we talk about this, people listening can tune into that for themselves. What are those younger layers? And how did they see things? What was it like to be you back when you were 10 years old, 6 years old? There's something very intimate about that. And people, I think, often defend against that intimacy with their innermost layers because it feels vulnerable or scary or unfamiliar, just simply unfamiliar. They're not used to turning the microscope back or the telescope back toward themselves. And then it gets really interesting. Like, do you care about that? Those younger parts, when you regard yourself as a kid, do you like that person? And people can ask themselves that question, what's our relationship with the younger part? It's quite concrete, right? It takes what we're saying and brings it really down to earth, which I think is an important thing here. And then you can ask yourself, what kind of journey did they have to take through their childhood? What did they have to deal with? What were the hardships, the tough knocks? How did they overcome them? What was beautiful about it? So this kind of goes to what's, you know, forming a more heroic, I'll use that language, or
yeah,
you know what I mean? A more, you know, I don't know what.
Aspirational,
yeah,
something
yeah,
like that.
Kind of yeah, journey. Yeah.
So you're speaking to some narrative therapy stuff here, Dad. I would say loosely, I'm not a therapist at all, but I'm certainly not a narrative therapist. And so anything that we do here talking about narrative therapy is just through the lens of more general understanding than like real intimate understanding. We'll probably have a narrative therapist who listens to this episode who's like, you kind of got 80% of the way there, but I'll take 80%. But one of the key insights, I think, from narrative therapy is that how we tell a story matters. That's insight number one, that our lives are made up of stories, and the stories that we tell about ourselves inform our behavior and our actions. Not just like in the past, what happened, but in the future, how we act based on how we think about ourselves. And the second really, really important insight is that stories are malleable. Mm. They're not all one thing or all another thing. They're made up of all of these parts. There are a lot of different ways most of the time to interpret what happened. And what that means is there's an opportunity for us. If our behavior has been stymied by a certain kind of story that we're telling about ourselves, we can look for ways to tell that story a little bit differently and maybe tell it in ways that encourage the behavior that we want to live into in the future. Do you think that's kind of a fair summary there, Dad?
Great summary. And I think it has to do with what we highlight and also the meanings that we give things. Understandably, very often, we tell a story of our youth in terms of things that happened to us, things that pushed us around one way or another, things that we couldn't do anything about. Okay, consider the same events, but instead focus on your own agency. Focus on yourself as an active witness of what was around you, guiding yourself in terms of your reactions to it, and making choices about what would be best for you. That's a different kind of story. My narrative about myself a lot emphasized how sort of intellectual I was, you know, as a good student and all that.
Yeah, same.
And yeah, except lately, so last years, I've kind of looked back on that and seen more what a really warm, kind, sweet kid I was. It's just a different narrative, same events, but different point of emphasis. So what do you emphasize, right, in how you tell the story? Another aspect of it has to do with going through school. I mean, my general view, and I say this with enormous respect for educators. I think there's a special place in heaven for educators. I think the standard conventional school system as well is a good fit for about a third of the kids. I was in that group. I think it's okay. It's not great for another third, roughly. And it's really a poor fit with about a third of the population, irrespective of intelligence. And so if you were in that two-thirds, for whom, you know, 6 hours a day for 12 years, 5 days a week, 9 months a year, maybe more, was not always a lot of fun for you, and it shaped how you feel about yourself, you know, a part of is the narrative that, you're just not very smart, or, frustration and futility and pessimism when you face certain kinds of tasks, like filling out the financial aid application for college or going through the licensure requirements to become a therapist. Well, wait a second here. Maybe there's a different story to tell, a story in which you were unwittingly dropped in, you know, into a kind of a challenging, understandably challenging institution, and you that really focused on performance in ways that were not really well suited to you, and kept trying to force you as a round peg into a square hole. And maybe a different story is that you did a great job coping with a pretty messed up environment, and you did the best you could in it. And it's unfortunate what happened, and still you made the best of it. And look where you are today.
Totally. That's a great example of this, Dad.
Yeah.
And I really feel that one of the most important and impactful skills that a person can develop in their life is the skill of flexibility, the ability to see a situation through different kinds of lenses.
You and Stephen Hayes.
Yeah. A lot of respect for Stephen and his work. And I, you know, obviously I'm a big fan of ACT. And there's a particular phrase that I want to pull out here that's from narrative therapy. And this is actually going to be a quote from Alice Morgan's book, What is Narrative Therapy? Which is one of the ones that I ran into when I was doing some research for this episode.
Yeah.
So there's this phrase called thin description, which narrative therapists use. And thin description allows little space for the complexities and contradictions of life. Doesn't let people articulate their own particular meanings of their actions and the context within which they occurred. So one form of this very narrow kind of telling a story is when we take onto ourselves as narratives the things that other people have said about us.
Ah.
We take on as identity the stories that other people are telling. For myself, as an example, I really took on the story of being that highly top-down, very judgmental, very cognitively driven person. Some of that was because I kind of felt that way.
Yeah.
But a lot of it was because, man, people said it about me often. And it's normal for an 8-year-old to be like, all these people are saying this thing about me. It must be true. But they're responding to your behavior, not to your interior.
Yeah.
And there's often a big gap between our behavior out in the world and how we actually feel inside. If anything, a lot of the time, particularly when you're a kid, your behavior is basically a defense against how you actually feel inside. So there's this kind of counterintuitive process where people out in the world really respond to our presenting self, and that just pulls us further and further and further away from who we actually are in the interior. And those stories are very powerful. Like the stories that we take on when we're 12 years old have a long tail over the rest of our life. And it took me, just using myself as an example, as somebody who works in like adjacent to mental health and does content creation in this world, it still took me a really long time, even though this is what I freaking do, to start to unravel some of those stories and really develop a different view of myself. So I thought that just that notion of like thin description was a really powerful idea.
Well, that's great. And it's an opportunity for us to develop a thicker description, as it were.
Yes, yes.
Along the lines of what I'm calling compassionate clarity. Maybe just kind of putting a bow in this first of our three R's.
Yeah.
I think in that compassion, you can have compassion for the suffering you dealt with, which is a very important way to reclaim your own interior, because we tend to dismiss and push away our own pain. But instead, compassion connects us with pain. It does it in a caring and loving frame, so we're not overwhelmed by the pain and burned out by it and hijacked by it. So it's really important to bring that kindness, that warmth that's in compassion to your pain, not just witness your pain or feel your pain. So you connect with yourself, and also looking around at the major players. It was a really important kind of clarity for me when I realized that my mom was grappling with some depression, I think, at certain points in my childhood, and also grappling with certain things that were missing for her from my father as a kind and decent and loyal guy who was, in a gender normative way, completely preoccupied with getting his own career started before he turned 40. He had his own treadmill, you know, his own journey to run. So I had compassion for him, compassion for my mom, and that was very freeing. So people can look back on all that, including, you know, compassion for the kids who bullied you. It doesn't mean that what they chose to do as a nasty 14-year-old, it did not happen. It just means that when you bring compassion to the suffering in them and what their own life was like at home and all the many factors that led them to do what they did, it brings wisdom for you. And it's soothing and reparative and healing to bring compassion to those other people that were players in your own childhood.
Yeah. And part of what I think you're highlighting here, Dad, is the ways in which we can fall into very black and white thinking about all of this.
Yeah.
When most of the time stories include a certain amount of yes and attached to
them. That's really true.
And another part of the compassionate inquiry part of this whole thing, I think, is focusing in on the capabilities that you have today that might have emerged even out of very challenging circumstances. I was talking with Elizabeth about this the other day. She has complex PTSD. She grew up in a very chaotic environment. And yet there were certain capabilities that emerged out of even those very difficult experiences. She's a very emotionally attuned person. She can really pay attention to how somebody else is feeling and track them very closely. And so for you listening, you might have had a very challenging experience and you are intimately aware of the many difficulties that it left you with, the many things that you're dealing with these days that feel like pain points to you. But along the way, there might also be some aspects where you can look back on and authentically say, wow, I kind of got this superpower out of these challenging experiences. And that can be another way of coming to terms with this whole thing. But I do want to turn toward the resupply part of your three R's here, Dad, which is, I think that you called it filling ourselves up with what was missing back then.
You've already started to allude to it with your, you know, notions.
Connecting the dots, you
know,
yeah.
Yeah, connecting the dots. And I want to, maybe before we just make the transition and turn the corner here, a last teeny little point. You have this great phrase, let the fizz out of the bottle. And part of what happens when we bring compassionate clarity to our own childhood is that, you know, as Freud put it, the return of the repressed and so forth, we become more aware maybe of what's been pushed away and we need to let it flow. So you want to comment a little on that? Then we'll make the full turn into
I think that resupplying. This is actually great, because this is one of those things that I think kind of straddles the line between reclaiming and resupplying, if that makes sense. One of the kind of key insights of psychoanalysis, one of Freud's fundamental ideas, is that psychic material, all of the thoughts, feelings, emotions, sensations, just all of the stuff boiling away inside of there, is never destroyed. It's indestructible in its nature. all of the experiences you've ever had are lodged inside of you in some way. And we could get into an argument about whether or not that's the case, but that's the idea. And so the notion is that if we don't work with things, they don't go anywhere. They just kind of keep on boiling away inside of us. And in the very beginning, I was talking about how in a unpleasant childhood or in a challenging childhood, what you often see are a lot of unexpressed or unfelt wants and needs and emotions. And those unexpressed things, they keep on bubbling along in the background. And I've intimately had this experience. Like, this is very, very real for me. And so one of the big parts of the getting more regulated process and getting healthier process in all of this is finding opportunities to let those things out in safe ways, hopefully in ways where you get positive feedback or no feedback at all, if that's what you're really looking for, about whatever it is that's going on. So I call that letting the fizz out of the bottle. Most people are walking around like a soda bottle that's been shaken one too many times. And what happens is they never express anything. And when they do express it, the whole soda bottle explodes. And it's just like, it just boils out of them. So what we need to do is find those little opportunities to let it out.
That's great. Right on.
If you're like me, you've probably started to pay closer attention to your long-term health as you've aged. Turning 35 was a bit of a wake-up call for me, and I'm always looking for good sources of information because it's often really difficult to separate fact from fiction when it comes to our physical health. We had Dr. Tim Spector on the podcast a few years ago. He's a professor of genetic epidemiology and the scientific co-founder at Zoe. And the Zoe Science and Nutrition podcast is truly one of the best resources out there when it comes to this stuff. With the help of world-leading scientists, they help you make smarter health choices every week. And you don't have to just take my word for it. Avid podcast fan Stephanie's Apple review says the Zoe Science and Nutrition podcast is a life-changing, science-based, myth-busting podcast. That's a must-listen for anyone who eats food and wants to understand how it affects their body. With the Zoe Science and Nutrition podcast, you can join Stephanie and millions of others transforming their health. Find it wherever you listen to podcasts. If you like being well, I think you'll really enjoy the Dr. John Delaney Show. Dr. John's show was recently in the top 5 of all podcasts on Apple Podcasts, which is just an incredible accomplishment, and it speaks to how much value people get out of the show. Dr. John has a PhD in counseling, and he's been working with people for over 20 years, and the show has a very cool format. Real people call into the show, and he walks them through how to navigate a tough situation related to common challenges. Maybe it's something related to their relationships, anxieties, or emotional well-being. He explores a lot of topics that are similar to what we talk about on this podcast, but while we can sometimes be pretty theoretical in nature, the format of John's show just creates a lot of directness and practicality to it. I think it's actually a really nice complement to what we do here on Being Well. No matter what you're going through, the Dr. John Delaney Show is here for you. And if you ever need some advice, you know who to call. Listen to the Dr. John Delaney Show wherever you get your podcasts, or follow the link on our website. As somebody who's really struggled with skin issues like acne over the course of my life, I know just how great it is to not stress about what's going on with your skin. That's why I'm excited to tell you about today's sponsor, OneSkin. Their products make it easy to keep your skin healthy while looking and feeling your best. No complicated routine, no multi-step protocols, just simple, scientifically validated solutions. The secret is OneSkin's proprietary OS01 peptide. It's the first ingredient proven to work with the aging cells that cause lines, wrinkles, and thinning skin. And as somebody who's used plenty of complicated routines in the past, I love the simplicity of using their OS01 face topical peptide. Just cleanse, pat your skin dry, and apply it twice daily. Get started today with 15% off using code BEINGWELL at oneskin.co. That's 15% off oneskin.co with code BEINGWELL. After your purchase, they'll ask you where you came from, and please support the show and tell them that we sent you. Earlier, I was talking about we figure out what's painful back then, what the consequences were for it today. And this totally connects with an idea of yours that I love, which is like finding your vitamin C. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. A person could ask themselves, back then, what would have made all the difference in the world? And in particular, what would you have experienced if back then things had been different in some ways. And that experience is very often really, really important medicine that you can look for today. So for me, for example, you know, one key experience I didn't have very much was I didn't feel seen or wanted in groups. And so for me, you know, for many, many years, I've been very deliberately looking for experiences of being seen and wanted in groups. And then when I have those experiences, to take it in. I'm interested, Forrest, like what you're looking for today, that's a kind of a vitamin C. You know, the analogy being that if we have scurvy, you could eat protein or take B vitamins, but they won't touch your need. If you have a flat tire, it's not going to be resolved by putting gas into the tank. So there's a helpfulness in matching key supplies today, matching those to empty, hollow places inside that are still left over from your childhood.
I think that's something a lot of people get trapped in, is filling the car with gas when they have a flat tire.
Yeah.
Because they're really good at filling the car with gas. For a lot of people, that's an example of that might be you have a lot of emotional needs, but you're really good at earning praise for various accomplishments.
Mm.
So people pursue accomplishment after accomplishment, hoping that the next accomplishment will be the one that like finally fills the hole. And they just find that it never does because it's not actually what they're looking for, not actually what they're caring about. I think that I fell into versions of that in the past, where I had a lot of self-identity that was driven by being good at stuff or being an accomplisher. And then I would get frustrated when I felt like I wasn't actually getting what I wanted for people, which was more that emotional nurturance side of the spectrum. These days, it's a tough question for me because I'm in a moment that where I feel like pretty stabilized about a lot of stuff. So it's actually a little harder for me to find a thing that I'm actively looking for in my life. For a very, very long time, it was the sense that people actually did like me. For sure, that was it. I went through most of my young adulthood feeling like I was at best somebody's third best friend when they were like my best friend. And so I always kind of felt like the kid who was about to be voted off the island and sometimes was voted off the island.
Mm.
And so that was a real source of anxiety for me in my social life. And thankfully, as time went on, I was able to find more secure groups of people where I could start to express some of those concerns that I have in healthy ways and be really met in them. And that went a long way toward dealing with that. But that was the dominant story for me for a long time.
Well, beautiful. What a great example. You know, and another version would be maybe somebody has a history in their childhood in which, understandably, they were helpless or immobilized around certain things. They couldn't overcome situations. Maybe they were in a highly controlling environment. Maybe forms of agency and full self-expression were punished, wasn't safe. So now, for them, their vitamin C, as it were, their compensatory medicine, the antidote medicine, would be something like really looking for experiences of potency, agency, efficacy, being more like a hammer than a nail, being able to really make things happen, influence things, be big, be loud, take up space. Oh my gosh, take up space. And wow, right there could be a really useful kind of compensatory experience for people so that you could get a supply. That's what I'm saying here, resupply yourself what was missing.
I think that for a lot of people who have challenging experiences in childhood, they feel like they pop out into adulthood with this real 1-2 punch, where on the one hand, they have a bunch of tendencies or patterns that they don't like. They have these relational patterns like anxious attachment that have consequences for their relationships today. Or maybe they have a lack of key skills. That could be the other hand that's coming toward you. A lack of relational skills, a lack of functional skills. Maybe they even feel inside of themselves the inability to learn new skills altogether. Like they're the kind of person who just can't learn things. And this combo is the consequence of what happened to them back then. It's the consequence of that challenging childhood. And a very, very powerful way to come to terms with back then is by feeling free of it in the here and now, doing things today to make it so you don't feel as burdened by the consequences of whatever went on in the past. And I think that the whole vitamin C idea is one way that you can kind of get to that, right? By filling yourself up with these experiences, you start to unburden yourself of the tendencies that were attached to the painful experiences that you had early on in life. Another version of that, though, gets to the more competencies side of the spectrum, where one of the reasons that the impact of an unhappy childhood or a difficult childhood can linger for people is because they feel stuck right now based on whatever happened to them in the past. Maybe they had a caregiver who was very emotionally attuned to them and really cared about how they felt and was like a very nurturing parent, but you know, you weren't totally sure if the permission slip for the field trip was going to get signed on time, and they definitely weren't teaching you how to do your taxes. And now here you are today, and you feel like you just don't have those basic skills. And I wonder about that developing competencies side of it as a kind of secret pathway to feeling less attached to the past in a way that can be very painful for people. What do you think about this?
Well, I'm pausing because I've never heard anyone say it like that. And so I'm really reflecting on it.
And this could be just like totally out of left field here, but I'm thinking of friends who felt very wrapped up in the past in a way that they didn't like. They didn't want to feel burdened by it in that way anymore. And one of the things that was keeping them wrapped up in it is that every time that they went to do their insurance, they felt totally incompetent because they just hadn't been taught any of those functional skills that might get them through that experience. And so you're touching the hot stove every single time that you don't have this competency you feel like you should have. And if they were able to actually gain those skills, it helped them gain more healthy separation from the past because they didn't feel like punished by it anymore. Does that make sense?
I think that's so useful.
Mm.
Really? I mean, you're framing it not just that the acquisition of these capabilities today would open doors for you or make life easier. In addition to that, it sort of brings a big scissors, the cosmic scissors, right? Rip, snip that cord that somehow of identity, right?
Yeah.
It goes back to your identity growing up as someone who was inept, incompetent, couldn't fill out an insurance form, and so forth. That's really interesting. I had a very bizarre experience when I went to my 20-year high school reunion. I walked in. I went to a big high school. So at the reunion, my graduating class had, oh, I don't know, 700 people in it probably. There were maybe 300, 400, 500 people there, well attended. And I went in and I felt shy. I felt awkward, even though at that point it was 20 years later. I'd done a personal growth work. I had a PhD at that point. You know, I had some distinction under my belt. I walked in and I had the eeriest experience that I could have been dropped in to just about to most 20-year high school reunions around the country with roughly the demographics, mainly white, middle class, of the high school that I went to in West Covina, California. And it was surreal. It was surreal. And it was very freeing. It was almost as if my various tortured memories of shyness and shame and humiliation and fear in high school just evaporated because they became, I don't know, kind of unmoored from anything real. It was liberating. And so, I don't know, there's kind of a version of that. It's not exactly what you're getting at, but there's some way of
cutting the cord.
Yeah.
Like breaking that phrase that you
free,
used.
Yeah. Yeah. Breaking free in some way. Like, I'm not that one. Yeah. There's some continuity, but no, that was then, this is now. So I think there's something definitely powerful in what you're saying.
As people go through that resupplying process, filling themselves up with whatever was missing, a big part of it for them can be those shame experiences. You alluded to shame just a second ago, because there can be this feeling of, well, I'm supposed to know this already, or I'm supposed to, why yet again can I not, whatever it is for you? And, you know, that's very, very difficult. And that's where I think probably some of the self-compassion comes into it that you were talking about earlier.
Right, in terms of how they are about it today.
Yeah.
And there's no shame. We're designed to be really affected by all that material. So now the other thing, when I say resupply, I also include soothing. Supplying ourselves today with soothing, comforting, you know, that good, sweet, tender stuff that may well have been missing when you were young. Maybe because your parents really did not know how things were landing on you for various ways. Maybe like I did, you wore a mask, you acted like everything was fine, and underneath it all, you were pretty miserable. Maybe that's what happened. Maybe something different happened for you. So one thing you could do is, as you know, in the acronym HEAL that I use to kind of summarize how to deliberately change your brain for the better, the L stands for linking, in which we're aware of positive and negative material more or less at the same time, keeping the positive bigger and helping it to be matched to the negative material and to make contact with it and ease it, soothe it, and eventually replace it. So one thing people can do on their own a lot, and if you want, with a therapist too, is to deliberately bring in experiences, positive experiences that are soothing for the younger layers of yourself. It really is possible to do that kind of thing for yourself. I mean, I've in my own imagination, I've seen myself in fourth grade standing around with a bunch of boys in physical education, PE, being picked last for a baseball team. And I've imagined, you know, kind of dropping in invisibly in the time machine and whispering in young Ricky's ear, hey, you're going to be okay. You're actually pretty athletic and you're young. It's not your fault. You haven't really learned these things. You're going to become in your own way, you know, kind of a badass rock climber at a certain point. And it's okay. Don't worry. Don't worry, you know, hang in there, hang in there. You're going to be doing stuff that's going to freak out these old, you know, studly older kids around you. Don't worry, don't worry. You know what I mean? Anyway, yeah, that's a good thing to do to bring that kind of soothing. Yeah.
And if you're able to have that conversation with your younger self in a way that doesn't make you totally cringe, then I think that it's a great exercise and can also be a great exercise if it makes you totally cringe.
The more cringe, the better, because then you're getting close.
Sometimes the more cringe. Yeah, hey, yeah. Sometimes the more cringe, the better. Totally, totally, totally. There was something I wanted to ask you about, Dad, which I think is a secretly huge part of this process for a lot of people. And I'm not sure which of these R buckets it tidally fits under. Maybe you could tell me. I think it's maybe got a little repair in it, maybe a little reclaim in it. And it's letting go of the childhood that you wished that you had had.
Yeah.
For a lot of people, this process is not just about coming to terms with the way that things were. It's about releasing the yearning for something different.
Yeah.
And man, I've just seen that be so hard for people. And I'm sure that you've worked with people around that in clinical practice.
Oh, that's really well said. And sometimes what comes up as a block to doing the active processes that we're describing of let's say, reclaiming and resupplying and then repairing, is that it draws people into admitting what was really true, what was missing, and things they did themselves that they have remorse and regret about. And so that involves a kind of healthy grieving, like you're saying, a kind of healthy mourning for the childhood that they will not ever have had. And being real about it. And I think there is something also sort of freeing about that. You know, it happened. It was what it was. Big breath, right? There's no changing what happened in the past. Big breath. Okay. There's a kind of freedom today in how I want to move forward. That's what you're describing. That's the experience of a kind of. And in that, I mean, I'm truncating really quickly. Process that might take months and might involve a lot of tears, you know, but you kind of work through the loss. It's a loss, right? And who among us has not experienced major loss? I mean, a few people have not experienced major loss, but most people, me included, have experienced major loss, including the loss of certain kinds of conditions or experiences that you deserved to have had as a vulnerable, innocent, precious child. So yes, there is something about that coming to terms with that loss in a way that doesn't keep revisiting it, you know, that actually fully processes it, not buttons it up and just moves on, but rather fully opens to it. But at a certain point, I've really seen this a lot for us around people processing loss. The two things you need to do. One is to really allow the organic process of experiencing to have its own rhythms.
Yeah.
On the one
hand. Fully feel the feelings. Yeah.
Yeah. And you may need to resource yourself to be able to do that. There can be a rhythm in it. Empty that bucket of tears, one spoonful of it at a time, and so forth. And the other second really, really important thing is to let yourself turn the corner when it's time. Hmm. Let yourself turn the corner when it's time. Even help yourself turn the corner when it's time. That does not mean denying the past. It just means that you're not preoccupied with it. You're not bound to it. You're not orbiting it. You've broken free in escape velocity. You may visit it from time to time, but it doesn't occupy you.
Yeah, I think that idea of being with something without it occupying you also gets to the third R that you have here, repair.
Yeah.
And particularly this idea that's been very real for me in my life of what I call functional forgiveness. We also called it disentangled forgiveness in our book Resilient that we wrote together. This idea that often we find freedom from things by getting to a place with them, not where we're excusing other people's behavior, mm-hmm. but where we understand that being wrapped up in something just isn't helping us anymore.
Yeah.
We see it clearly. It wasn't great. Whatever happened was truly problematic. And there's this acceptance piece of it where we get that they just aren't going to change in the ways that we want them to change. Or the past just isn't going to change because we can't change the past, whatever it is. Maybe we have a family member who just will not accept their role in something. And yet we also would like to have the kind of relationship with them where we see them at Thanksgiving. And in order to get through that 24 hours, like we've got to just kind of get okay inside of ourselves. And there's a way to get okay without pretending that what happened was okay. Like you can really do that. You can thread that needle inside of yourself. And so that's sort of the first thing that I would say about the repair part of this process. And I would like you to expand on that however you'd like.
And sometimes we do that with other people in an active way. Often we do it mainly inside our own minds.
I'd say 90% of it is inside your own mind for me, but.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I always invite repair with you, Forrest. If there's anything that you want to talk about,
for sure.
I'm
always good for
it. Yeah, and we are. We're very current with each other.
Yeah, yeah. And if you're in a relationship, what I mean to say is that if you have a relationship with somebody where you can actually do active repair with them, that is amazing.
Yeah.
10 out of 10, 5 stars, all day long, 2 thumbs up from Forrest, great. When you're more in that functional forgiveness world, you're typically there because repair has not gone well with this person.
Well said. Yeah.
Or they are not open to it, or they're not around for it. You know, like a lot of the repairing that we're doing is repairing with people who are no longer around, or experiences that are no longer around, situations that are no longer around. You can only really do that inside of your own mind.
Well, I'll mention something that is really powerful, and it may make people cringe. And the more it makes you cringe, probably the better it would be for you to do it. And that would be to deliver, you know, your undelivered communications to key people in your life history. It could certainly be parents and siblings. It might also be relatives. It could be toward your own children, although we're not really getting into that aspect of things. We're focusing more here on your own challenging childhood. It could be the other kids in school. So that process of delivering undelivered communications in your own imagination, you might want to write it out.
Yeah, I was going to ask, could you give like a couple examples of how to do this actually? Because I think exercise that might be helpful for people. Yeah.
So you could start a letter, dear mom. You know,
right, exactly. Oh, man, that doesn't make you cringe. I don't know.
Exactly.
What will.
I bet if we had a little meter attached to you, like a lie detector.
Oh, yeah, man.
Yeah. Yeah, bingo. You're right there. And I've had other dear mom, dear dad, dear big brother, dear
maybe,
big sister.
Maybe ask our video editor to put that in on the YouTube video for this one, the little cringe-o-meter rising.
Zing! Yeah. And then, whoa. And there are ways into this. Again, be careful. You don't want to be hijacked by it. Okay, got it. But one way to do it is to imagine writing a letter to your parents and deliberately writing it in an angry way, and then writing a second letter in a kind of a sorrowful way. Sorrowful, hurt, sad, let down kind of way. And then write the third letter that in a way is the integration of the first two as well as anything else. That's a kind of a coherent, a compassionately clear account of what it was like for you in some way. And you don't need to be daunted by it. You can just say it's going to be a page and that's all it's going to be. It doesn't need to take into account everything in your childhood. If you find yourself drawn into it, as you might, and you keep going, great. And then that's that. It doesn't mean you're ever going to mail it. You might want to keep it and come back to it later, or you might want to do some kind of ritual in which you perhaps burn it or make an offering of it in some way, maybe, or not at all, right? Whatever is appropriate for you. But that process of communicating to someone that you, that it's not possible or appropriate to communicate with can be really helpful. And then also, if you want, you can imagine, you can actually read the letter out loud. You can, this is an empty chair exercise from Gestalt therapy, but you can imagine your parents seated across from you and you read them the letter. And the setup is that you control the setting and they're just sitting there receptively. It's like their best self is present there to hear what you have to say. You could read it to them. You could imagine actually interacting with them directly and in a way in which they actually hear what you have to say. And in all that, there might be some accusations about them. There might be a lot of compassion from you for them, a lot of understanding, just telling the truth, just telling the truth. So whatever feels healing for you, often there's a kind of a wisdom, sometimes associated with cringing, where you just, you go into what would be healing to name, to say, to acknowledge. It can be seriously a significant experience for people if you do it. I've done this kind of thing for myself a lot.
And often this kind of work, at least in my personal experience, I haven't done this with other people. I've just done it for myself and seen some other people do versions of it. This kind of work takes place in cycles or waves.
Right.
Where you do this exercise once and it's one kind of way. Maybe it's pissed off. Maybe it's very tearful. Maybe it's kind of withdrawn, whatever it is. And then some time passes and you work around with these issues and you do the exercise again. And the exercise changes because of how you've changed in the interim. So you go through this cycle a couple of times. And there's something about that cyclical process that I actually think is just core to the repair of it, the healing of it.
That's right.
There's this great line, to loosely paraphrase it, from Diego Perez. He goes by Young Pueblo on Instagram, and he's also just a very good guy. It's something along the lines of, if the weight was very heavy, you will have to put it down many times. And I think that's a great summary of this process.
Yeah, beautifully said. Another way into this, by the way, in yourself, is to do sentence completions. So imagine a provocative stem like, Mom, I really wish you had fill in the blank. Dad, I really wish you had fill in the blank.
My geometer is rising.
Okay. Right. Or, you know, name your Sam. I just made up the name Sam. Sam's your brother. Sam, I really wish you hadn't fill in the blank. Dad, one thing I never told you is da-da. Or one thing I feel angry or sad or about is, right? So these are things also that can kind of bring it up. The more you're cringing here, whoever you are, the more this could be a good opportunity for you. And then when the dust settles, you know, the way I think of repair, it kind of can happen in three stages. One stage is the safest of all. It's entirely inside yourself. Second stage, you could share it with somebody else, like a good friend, maybe your partner, maybe a therapist, a minister, a rabbi, perhaps. And then third stage, you know, the riskiest of all, but often with the highest impact, is to interact with the other person directly, in which you just talk things through. And there's a lot of good advice in our book, Resilient, about how to have those kind of conversations. Nonviolent communication is a good format.
And NVC.
For a repair conversation. You know, what's the greater risk? To risk a sincere, good-hearted attempt at repair? It has some risks. Or the risks of not initiating repair while people are still alive. or the risks of not initiating repair inside your own mind if it's just not possible to communicate directly with the other person.
Yeah, there's something here that relates to a book I've been reading recently, which is by Irving Yalom, and it's called A Matter of Death and Life. And it's this beautiful, beautiful book. I would strongly recommend it if you're into these kinds of topics. And what do we actually want from this life? And for me, a huge piece of it is to do what I can to live without regret. To do what I can to get to the end of it and feel like, you know, did the best I could. Yeah. Didn't do perfect, but I did the best I could. And so one way to reflect on some of these questions, and maybe particularly questions about repair, just boil down to, what are you going to regret? And what do you feel like you're not going to regret? You know, what will you wish you had done when you get to the end of this? And for some people, that's going to be, you know, I am real happy I never talked to that person about these issues. And that was a great call by me. And for some people, it's not going to be that way at all. And they really wish they had had the conversation with that friend or that family member, that significant other. And the lack of that conversation has hung over their head in some way for many, many, many years. And you do see that in a lot of people.
Wow. I feel we really talked through a lot here.
Yeah.
And
I was sort of suspicious of whether or not we could do this in one episode when we started, because it's such a huge topic, but I feel really good about it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's great. And the last thing I want to say, I think related to all this, is to acknowledge that we've been really talking about the layer of the psyche that is autobiographical. It's very related to the sense of self, and that's fine. It's interesting to also, in terms of coping with a challenging childhood, our headline here, to be aware of a layer in your own consciousness that is actual, that is independent of events that occur, and was never itself damaged or stained or altered by things that happened to you. It was underneath it all. It was witnessing. Many people talk about this kind of layer in their consciousness. It seems almost impersonal. It's not gendered. It doesn't have your personality. It observes your personality. It's aware of your personality. It's that deeper level of being, you could say. And that part of you, that level, that layer, that ground in you is intact. And knowing that it was never harmed by all that happened to you and the things you did, it was just independent of all that. And It's precious. It's a fundamental aspect of your own innate goodness. And I just want to name that. People may not have any sense of what I'm talking about. A lot of people, including me, do. And it's a real resource to realize, okay, all that stuff happened. It affected my personality, and I'm still affected today, and I'm still involved in a process of reclaiming and resupplying and repairing today. Okay, good. And there is a layer of me that I can be in touch with and I can acknowledge that's independent of all that. Independent of all that. Yeah. And that's useful to bring in if it's meaningful for you.
That's great, Dad. And I think that's also a great note to end our conversation today on. This is one of the biggest topics in mental health and psychology and personal growth. And we could spend, if not several, then essentially every episode we ever do on the podcast on some version of this topic. But I feel really good about how much of it we were able to explore today. And I just really appreciate all of the material that you brought to the table here, Dad. I thought it was really wonderful.
Yeah. That's great.
I really enjoyed today's conversation with Rick about coming to terms with a challenging childhood, and was really happy with the framework that Rick had of reclaim, resupply, and repair. And I thought that those three words really captured most of the process of what we do when we start to do this kind of work. Starting with reclaiming, that's telling the story of what happened. And we can be informed by some techniques from narrative therapy, which I talked about a bit during the conversation. This is when we create a coherent narrative of childhood. What happened? Who did what?
What were things actually like for us? Importantly, what was missing? And then maybe what was also present? Another piece of this could be exploring some of the consequences of what was missing for you back then. What were the things that you needed that you didn't receive? What were the needs that you had that went unexpressed in childhood? And how did that lead to whatever you're experiencing today that you're trying to work with? Then we resupply. We try to fill ourselves up with whatever was missing back then. That list that you might have generated of all the things that you didn't have and the consequences of it today, that's your map. That's the diagram you need to figure out what you can do practically in the here and now to deal with some of these problems. And this is Rick's idea of finding your unique vitamin C. A lot of people go through life trying to hydrate themselves when what they really need is to eat a little bit more protein. We're often really good at finding certain kinds of resources, and sometimes those resources just aren't the ones we actually need. Maybe we're really, really good at seeking out various forms of accomplishment in life, but not so good at opening ourselves up to emotional intimacy. But it's the emotional intimacy that we're really looking for here. Another way that we could resupply is by developing some of the key competencies that we might not have learned or been taught back then. People often feel burdened by their past because it has consequences for them in the present. And every time that they bump into one of those consequences, they feel the pain of that past. So one of the best ways to cut the cord between now and back then is by developing whatever skills you need these days that you weren't able to learn. And that requires a basic sense of self-efficacy. And this is the belief that we have in ourselves that we are capable of doing what we need to do in order to solve different kinds of problems. Along the way in the categories of reclaiming and resupplying, we talked about a lot of different specific things, including some ideas from narrative therapy. One of the ones that I found particularly interesting while I was doing the prep for this episode was the idea of thin description. And this is description that just doesn't have a lot of space in it for a different kind of interpretation. One of the most important insights from narrative therapy is that we can tell the story of our life in a lot of different ways. Stories are complicated. Life has a lot of different characters in it. We can attribute different kinds of intentions to those characters. We can interpret the story in many, many different ways. But people, when they first go through this process, often start with a very locked, calcified version of their personal story. And it takes a lot of deliberate reflection to find the space in it that they need to interpret things in a different kind of way. But as you go through this process and you start to unpack it, all of these other possibilities begin to open up for people. And a particular kind of thin description, that kind of tight, narrow, unchangeable interpretation of what's going on, is the stories that other people tell about us, and particularly the characteristics that they attribute to us. It's totally understandable and very normal for an 8-year-old or a 13-year-old to really believe the stories that other people tell about you. But those stories that they tell are based on your external behavior, not who you actually are inside of yourself. And as we know from understanding psychological defenses, a lot of the time our external behavior has very little to do with what's going on inside. Or maybe a better way to put it is that it's actually the opposite of how we really feel. To use myself as a kind of example here, there was sometimes just such a desperate need for connection that I had that it would lead to behaviors that ended up pushing other people away. So what happens? We start to tell a certain kind of story about that person. Maybe they're a top-down, really cognitive, not very sensitive kind of individual, but that was very different from how I felt about myself on the inside. But it took a really long time for me to get back to the authentic version of who I was because there was so much story that was getting in the way. At the end of the episode, we talked about the repair step, and that really highlights the role of forgiveness in this whole thing. As we go through this process, it's really natural to have some feelings pop up about all the people who were involved. Maybe those were your caregivers, maybe it were friends, other people in the family system. Hey, maybe it's with yourself. And forgiveness is always volitional. You don't have to offer it to somebody else. It's up to you. If it's coerced, there is no point here. But sometimes people can find a lot of freedom from things by moving into what I call functional forgiveness. This isn't thinking that what somebody else did was okay. It's not justifying their behavior. It's not even really forgiving them in the conventional sense of the word. It's just getting to a place where you can be functional in relationship with this person. And Rick talked about a number of different techniques here that could be useful for a person. I really liked the one that he described where you're writing that letter. Maybe it's to somebody else. Maybe it's to a younger version of who you are. But whoever it's to, you can go through cycles of letter writing where maybe you start by writing one kind of letter. Then you go through some processing around this material. And 6 months later, you go, huh, it's time to write a different letter. And what I found in my own life is that letter changes a lot over time. And you can even look at the ways that it's changed. And sometimes that can give you some more insight into yourself and your nature and what really matters to you as time goes on. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. I really liked this one. I was very happy with it. And if you did enjoy it, I would love it if you could leave a comment down below if you're watching on YouTube, or maybe a rating and a positive review if you're listening through some podcast platform like Spotify or Apple. That really does help us out. If you'd like to support the show in other ways, you can find us on Patreon. It's patreon.com. And for just a couple dollars a month, you can support the show and receive a bunch of bonuses in return. Things like transcripts of the episode and ad-free versions of what we create. Until next time, thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you soon.